Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Larry Massett. Science, they tell you, is a great adventure, a journey into the unknown. But then, in the next breath, they tell you it ain't just walking around in the woods following your nose, either. Before you set out, you are supposed to have a plan, a theory. You need to know, or think you know, where you are going and what you will find. Darwin, I think it was, said that without a theory, you might as well head off to the nearest gravel pit and begin collecting the pebbles. Both of these views are correct. Science is accident and romance and adventure on the one hand, and on the other, calculation and careful forethought. Once in a while, if you're lucky, as we are today, both sides will come together. Dust off your slide rule now, polish up your microscope, and strap on a life jacket as we join producer Wesley Horner on a scientific voyage of discovery.
5 a.m., August 8. Winds calm, partly overcast with large swells. 20 miles off the coast of Delaware, in 130 feet of water, just past the light buoy known as Raycon 3, guiding transatlantic ships to Cape May, New Jersey, at the mouth of Delaware Bay. I am tossed in my bunk aboard the 55-foot motor sailor named Alka I. We are a crew of five on an ocean passage from the Chesapeake Bay to the Gulf of Maine, a voyage of scientific research. I have finished my first watch at the helm, more than 4 grueling hours of hard work trying to keep this 35 tons of fiberglass and metal on a narrow compass heading given to me at midnight by our captain. The swells push the bow first to starboard, then to port. It is a constant fight, pulling the huge wheel one direction, and then seconds later the opposite, like standing on the back of a huge, watery, wild horse. My shoulders and my arms ache. I am cold. There is a film of salt on my skin. For the 48 nautical miles on this watch, First Mate Chris Luckett and I strain to see through the dark at sea for the tiny flashing red light that is our mark. We keep a sharp lookout for any telltale shadowy movements that could be a freighter, deadly to our little boat. When we finally reach the buoy, I am so sleepy that I struggle to keep my eyes open. "Don't hit it," shouts Chris. I've been so intent on reaching it that I didn't realize how close I've brought the boat to running it down. Now I try for sleep. Not easy when your bed is rolling side to side through 90 degrees and pitching forward and back through 5 or 6 feet of air all at once. My ear is next to the hull. Through an inch of fiberglass, I hear the Atlantic Ocean slopping at our sides. If I put my other arm out, I can almost touch the aluminum mast. It towers 60 feet above our heads, runs through the deck into my teak-paneled cabin, and finally rests on the lead keel below. 3 weeks before, this mast acted as a lightning rod, pulling in a bolt from a Southern Virginia thunderstorm that fried all the electronics aboard. I think about the saying, "Lightning never strikes the same place twice." Halfway down my bunk, a small porthole is propped open, and I can feel the constant stream of salty air across my chest through the blankets. I am in heaven. Born in landlocked Western Pennsylvania, I got the bug to go to sea as a 13-year-old kid, reading a National Geographic about a boy just 3 years older than me, who sailed around the world in a 23-foot boat. And now, 26 years later, I have spent my first night at sea. Our voyage began in Gloucester, Virginia, where our captain, Walter Ady, and his wife Karen live on a farm on the shores of the lower Chesapeake Bay. Walter is director of the Marine Systems Laboratory at the Smithsonian Institution. He's got an accent that betrays his New England roots and a seagoing, always slightly ruffled look that speaks of generations of Newfoundland sailors and fishermen.
How's everything going over at the floating ranch there?
Floating ranch is ready to go to sea.
Really? Did they get the steering fixed? Because other things we can get around, but that is sort of central.
Yeah, you gotta steer.
Through the trees from the farmhouse is an outbuilding, glowing now with brilliant light. It is Walter's lab away from the lab, a miniature version of the tanks on view at the Smithsonian. Here, the converted barn houses four or five smaller tanks, miniature ecosystems, replicas of tropical reefs and the coast of Maine.
Well, there are several ways to look at how a coastal ecosystem works. One of the easy ways to think of it, because of the analogy in the control system here, is that in the world ocean, the huge body of water that extends around the world, on half of that ocean, the sun is always shining. And so there's always a large amount of photosynthesis going on. Let's say half the world ocean at any one time is always photosynthesizing.
And the lights just went off on the other side of the room. What's happening?
It's dusk. It's dusk. The sun is going down in our little ecosystems. And in this case, it's all electronically controlled. In the wild, it's the sun going down. So what we've done is to simulate a system that is like the world biosphere, in the sense that when the sun goes off here, the sun comes on up here. And so it's on in either one place or the other. How do you manage an ecosystem in miniature? That's the trick. And it's a real trick. And it's a trick that as humans, we need to know in our biosphere at large, because we have become so omnipresent in the world's biosphere that we humans, human society, are to the whole biosphere as I, a scientist, am to this tank. And if we don't know how to handle this ecosystem in miniature here, then we can't do it in the wild, because the whole biosphere has become like this tank.
Come up, Chris, if you could take a last look around the engines, especially in any of the few areas we worked in, and see if you see any leaks.
Nature in the wild is exactly what we are seeking. 570 nautical miles and 5 or 6 days by sea away are the real-life versions of these miniatures. And for this, we have loaded the sailing vessel Alka I with 3 months of food, diving equipment, a 6-person life raft, 2 inflatable skiffs, and 360 gallons of diesel fuel, enough for 1,000 nautical miles at a speed of about 7 knots. We have scrubbed the bilge, lubricated dozens of shivs, replaced hundreds of feet of line, checked our twin 300-foot anchor chains. It will be our diving platform, our floating laboratory, our home at sea. It is our third day at sea, and we are under sail. Fishing off the diving platform on the stern, Chris and Kate have landed a beautiful Spanish bonito, means pretty boy, and later, a big-eyed tuna. There is no land in sight. We all five stare at the sun setting into the ocean, enjoying glasses of wine and the last of the tuna steaks and asparagus dinner I've made. Chris and Kate's tuna was chasing a school of smaller fish, and the tuna were no doubt being chased by something larger. It was the food chain in action, and our full bellies are part of it.
Really is amazingly steady wind for this climate. It's been blowing between 10 and 12 all day. It shifted a little from southeast to more southerly.
We stayed under sail. When would we get the promised town?
Well, we're at the present time, assuming we only don't lose any more than a few hours, we'll get there at 4 or 5 in the afternoon.
Walter's attention to the wind, the waves, and the sky are non-stop. There is salt water in his veins, I'm convinced. As we sail north, the water gets colder, the accent gets thicker. Being at sea is a good time and place to tell stories. Walter tells me his, of the first vessel he owned many years ago in Gloucester, Massachusetts.
I needed a boat, so I went out and I bought an old pogey thing. You know, they look like lifeboats, and of course it cost more than I ever thought it would. 6 months later, by the time I got ready to go. And so came the issue of caulking it. And it had been caulked, but it had been sitting up in the dock for a year because the fishery wasn't good. So I thought about it, and I forget what it was, $500. It seems minuscule today, but then that was mountainous to me. I bought the boat for $700. So I said, it'll swell up after we get it in the water for a bit. And they do. So we put it in, and it started leaking, of course, and it's going to take 48 hours to swell up. And I put an automatic bilge pump aboard, and I was sleeping right there on the dock and watching it. Well, during the night, the bilge pump jammed, and so it started filling up, and I was checking it every couple of hours, and I saw this, and I got down there, and I couldn't get the bilge pump running. This is 3 a.m., and so I had this hand bilge pump, so I got in there going. And I was staying with it. I stayed with it for a couple of hours. But then, you know, about 6 a.m., I was really getting tired and there's nobody around. And finally, about 6:45, the yardage started work at 7. This fellow walked by getting ready to work, and he was a caulker. That was his job. He was a professional caulker. And I said to him, you know, just take the pump for a few minutes while I run up to the shed and see if I can find another. And he said, no, should have been caulked. Walked up the dock, and it sank right underneath me. And, you know, 3 weeks later, it finally sailed off. A hard way to start a lifetime at sea. And it worked. It taught me a lesson right from the beginning. I never had to go through that since. I've never had an accident at sea.
Casco Bay, Maine, part of the thousands of miles of coastal bays and inlets in this state. Winds are northwest, west-northwest, 5 to 15 knots. Seas calm. This brisk, brilliantly sunny morning, we have gone ashore from the sailing vessel Alka-Ai, bundled in woolen hats, heavy coats, and hip boots, to slosh through algae on the intertidal, that area where the sea meets the land. The summer tourists have abandoned Cape Elizabeth, a sharp, treeless outcropping into Casco Bay near Portland.
What made you decide to study the entire Gulf of Maine?
It doesn't work as individual bays, but it does work as a Gulf of Maine. When you step outside the Gulf, things change to rather different systems quickly. Whereas the Gulf, particularly driven by the big tide, and that's Gulf-wide, that's a whole Gulf of Maine feature is that big tide, and that's what's unique about it. But that is the concise element that you can treat as a unit. And I must admit, it's looking a little bit mind-boggling right now. But
our digging around on these rocks, counting and recording algae growth, plants, and animals, is part of Walter's research on the ecology of this vast, complicated body of water.
I
guess we'll start on the Ascafilm since there's so much of it. That's all that. We can weigh this now.
Point two.
The muscle coverage. It's about 75%. Barnacles.
Algae are widely misunderstood. It's public impression, and indeed the impression of a lot of scientists that they don't work in the field are that algae are slimy little things, such as what you typically see in a pond. Algae are at least as varied as all animals, including the range from lobsters, for example, jellyfish, to cows. Well, algae have that kind of range. Most of the algae, this big mass of algae here, for example, those are brown algae. That's like a phylum of brown algae. But growing on this are red algae, for example. Very different kind of organism, different kind of reproduction. And down here, here's some more red algae, for example. Here are some green algae, which are probably the precursors of the higher plants that have gradually worked their ways up hundreds of millions of years ago to lead to the higher plants.
If we were really lucky, in some places we might find lunch under here.
Well, yeah, the mussels are certainly lunch, especially now during the summertime. It's good to eat them because of the kind of plankton that they sometimes eat. But right now, sure, we could have a nice lunch right here in the intertidal.
I don't know why. I can't explain it, but there is something about studying the creatures of the sea that makes me want to eat at least some of them. While Chris and Brian continue to count plants and animals, Walter takes me on a tour of the rocks.
So right now, what we're particularly looking at is what is the effect of the surface of the rock, the irregularities of the surface of the rock on the biomass of algae. And we think that it's fairly obvious. If you just wander around through the algae, push some of it aside, and look at where it is and where it isn't, the gross roughness of the surface has a major effect. And then we're trying to quantify surface roughness and compare it to the abundance of the algae and the abundance of mussels and barnacles. And we're here today because this is one of the most exposed places on the coast of Maine. And we're comparing that to less exposed places, protected places. We're comparing that with shores in Nova Scotia, in New Brunswick. So we're doing this on a Gulf-wide basis. And I think that's pretty important because we need to understand the regional variables. You see, we think one of the primary variables here is that the algae needs, on the average, as a whole, some kind of partly protected surface, particularly one that can trap just a little bit of water to attach. And that's a critical variable. And if that happens, in fact, the algae are very competitive. Once they're attached, they're there for at least 5, maybe 10, 12 years. And the mussels and the barnacles are not going to move them out.
The work sounds daunting. The body of water is huge, the factors are complex, the data boundless. But it is hard not to be drawn in by Walter's peculiar mixture of science and romance for the sea, especially here on the Maine coast, especially on a beautiful, tough New England day. His passion for the ocean and for what makes it work is irresistible, like the enormous tides that make this region work.
What I'm thinking is that the Gulf of Maine, as hard as it may be to believe, has become one huge aquaculture. It's like we've made the Gulf of Maine a big farm, but we don't know what we're doing with it. We hardly understand any of the pieces of it. And our particular interest here in this case is seaweed. And you might say, well, it looks pretty and smells nice and all those good things. But seaweeds are the plants of the coast. And we have plankton plants out there in the water, and there's a lot of eating of plankton plants. But the seaweeds in the intertidal and the upper subtidal grow much, much, much faster than the plankton. So they provide a major portion, ultimately, of the food for the coastal waters. And so it makes a big difference whether there's lots of seaweed or not much seaweed. And so how are we affecting this?
Six a.m. Winds have shifted to the west, 10 to 15 knots. Skies are clear, becoming partly cloudy. Seas are calm, waves 1 to 2 feet. I am awakened by the faint sunrise reflecting off waters of South Portland Harbor and through the tiny porthole in my bunk.
Good morning.
There is tea brewing in the galley. Walter is already checking the weather forecast and plotting a course for the day's cruise out into Casco Bay. Life on board is sweet. Our destination is a tiny cove between Long Island and Vail Island. Walter and the crew launch the inflatable skiff and dive from it in this 50-degree water for specimens.
I'd like to kind of sort a little bit and see what we got.
This is Asterius. There's another
sea urchin,
Strongylus introitus. The Buccinum is now getting ready to crawl on the side
of
the
crew. It has been a good dive. My recording engineer, John Paulson, and I have stood watch in the Alka I, the mother ship, at anchor, waiting for Walter and the others to return with their boatload of white styrofoam picnic coolers full of plants and animals bound for study and exhibition in tanks replicating this environment at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C.
Why would people in Iowa be concerned with understanding the Gulf of Maine?
The ocean and the coast is important to people everywhere. What's easy to forget if you're in Iowa and you're looking out across the fields and all you can see is corn till it goes out of sight, it's easy to forget. And in fact, 3/4 of the world is ocean. And what's even more critical than that, because you may say, well, I get seasick and I don't ever want to go to sea, so I don't care about the 3/4 of the world. Well, it's ocean and people shouldn't be on the ocean anyways. They were never made to go out there. You could say that, the hell with the ocean. But the fact of the matter is all life, including us, requires water. So we're rapidly underway to messing up our whole oceans. And we can't do that because they control climate. By and large, they provide the water that rains down on the surface of the earth. There are hundreds of organisms, thousands of species in the ocean that we really don't understand how and why they work, and we don't know what's going to happen if they're gone. And so it is important to even the people in Iowa as to what's going on in the ocean as a whole. And if we can't understand the Gulf of Maine, how are we ever going to understand the ocean?
Let her go.
We are anchored at Jewel Island in eastern Casco Bay, 43 degrees 41 minutes north, 70 degrees 5 minutes west. The boat that has been our home, our lab, our recording studio, will be hauled tomorrow for the winter, lifted entirely out of the water by a powerful crane, drained of its fluids, its hull scrubbed.
All right, get in.
We are on its final cruise for the season, and last night we celebrated by taking part in the food chain, filling the cabins and galley with the steam from our bowls of fresh harvested mussels and lobster.
Tiny island. Quite frankly, I'd take this as compared to a tropical island, in spite of the winter.
On this, one of the outermost islands in Casco Bay, Walter Ady and I stare eastward to the open ocean. His boat's name is Alka Eye, short for Alcat Impennis.
The Alka Eye is the original scientific name of the great auk. And the great auk was a penguin-like bird that frequented the North Atlantic. It was flightless. And early fishermen heavily preyed on it for food. It was a very easy food to get. They'd bring their boats up to the side of a rock that had thousands of Alka Eyes on it, great auks, and would just march them into the ship and load them up for food on long voyages. So by the time we got into the 1800s, Alka Eye was struggling, Alka Impennis. And the early natural historians, the scientists, were very interested by this huge flightless bird with a huge egg, a single egg, and they collected it out of existence.
Why did you choose that name?
Well, to memorialize what humans can do to their environment, even scientists.
Walter Ady, director of the Smithsonian Institution's Marine Systems Laboratory. If naming his sailing vessel after an extinct seabird is a memorial, how much more so, surely, is his life's work trying to help us understand the ecology of this body of water, the Gulf of Maine? Whether studied in indoor tanks in a Washington, D.C. lab, or here in the wild, it's clear that as much as the sun, plants, animals, tides, or the rocky coast of Maine itself, how it all works together, and our part in it, may be one important clue to the evolution and survival of life on Earth.
Tides of Maine was produced by Wesley Horner in association with Radio Smithsonian. The associate producer was Rob Ludera, studio engineer John Paulson. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU at the American University. Thanks also to WVPN. Today's program is funded by the National Science Foundation. Additional support is provided by this and other NPR member stations and the NPR Information Fund, whose contributors include, for coverage of technological innovations, the Lemelson Foundation, investing in America's economic future. Write us. Write Soundprint, 4000 Brandywine Street, Northwest, Suite 620, Washington, D.C., 20016. Cassettes are $12.50. If you would like to order a cassette with a credit card, call us at 202-885-1285. That's 202-885-1285. On the internet, our address is soundprint@american.edu. Soundprint is technical director Anna Maria De Freitas, studio engineer Robin Wise, production assistant Francesca Raymond. The executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Larry Massey. This is NPR, National Public Radio.